Hi, and welcome to the OzBuzz channel. Today we are very fortunate to have with us Stuart Ross. Stuart and I have been talking a lot of different things about the legal world. We talked about flipping taxes and capital gains exemption and title insurance matters. And today I'm really looking forward to talk to some detailed law cases. Welcome, Stuart.
Thank you, Ozzy, for having me again.
Well, the one thing I'm really looking forward to is that you have some cases that talk about things, wonderful things that only lawyers like, certificate of pending litigation, you know, whatever that is. I'm looking forward to that. And then you're going to show us actual cases that sort of how a foreign buyer was treated under the taxes, that tax situation we have in BC, how the Court of Appeal talked about a $26 million contract dispute. So I look forward to that. And maybe we can start with that recent case that you had regarding a certificate of a pending litigation.
Thanks, Ozzy. What I thought we'd do today and maybe over the next little while is we could kind of put together a case law rapid fire where hopefully in under 10 minutes, I can go through and hit some highlights of recent cases, real estate cases that have come out of BC, and hopefully address what might have been done differently or things for lawyers or agents to keep in mind when they're structuring deals or structuring their companies or something like that to avoid some of these situations.
That's good.
So the first case I had here was R Style Enterprises Limited versus 1308879 BC Limited. And this is a 2026 case of the Court of Appeal. And this is the case that you had mentioned a moment ago about the CPL, which is a certificate of pending litigation. And to properly summarize this case, I suppose the first thing I should address is what is a certificate of pending litigation? A certificate of pending litigation, which was formerly referred to as a list pendus in British Columbia, is a registered charge on title to property, which notifies the public that the land is subject to an active court action. It effectively freezes the title and prevents the owner from selling or transferring or otherwise dealing with the property until the lawsuit is resolved and the CPL is removed. Now, the background of this very quickly in the R Style case is that the buyer entered into a contract to purchase 10 lots for $11 million and paid a 10% deposit of $1.1 million. The contract required the seller to provide certain services to the boundaries of the property, you know, sewer, drainage, water, things like that. And the buyer was supposed to complete the purchase within 30 days of being advised that the servicing had been completed. Of course, after the seller provided notice that the servicing had been completed, a dispute arose as to whether or not those services had in fact been completed per the contract, right? I mean, you know, the usual pick a fight kind of thing. So, of course, the seller, the buyer refused to complete. The seller alleged a breach of contract and the usual, we allege breach and we claim your deposit. The buyer subsequently filed a CPL on title to the subject property, and the seller brought a court application to remove the CPL from the property. That's how you get a CPL removed if the other party's being a cooperative, is that you go to court.
The deposit in this case, you had to pay it back?
The deposit in this case, what the case really dealt with in this case here was not whether or not they had to pay the deposit back, but whether or not the buyer had a right to maintain a CPL on the property when the deposit was still in limbo. Whether the deposit gets returned or the deposit gets kept by the seller would actually depend on who was in breach. If the seller was in breach, they'd obviously have to give the deposit back. If the buyer was in breach, the seller gets to claim the deposit, but that's an issue that was obviously being disputed. So in the interim, the buyer had a CPL on title. And this case is significant as the Court of Appeal, in overturning the Supreme Court, confirm that a purchaser has a right to file a CPL in these circumstances to protect their deposit. So if a buyer doesn't agree that they are in breach, they can file a CPL on title to protect their deposit so the seller can't just walk away from it. That was really the crux of this case, is the Court of Appeal confirming, because they overturned the decision of the lower court.
Right.
The lower court determined that they weren't allowed to do that, and the Court of Appeal said no, you are allowed to maintain a CPL in that case to protect your deposit.
Particularly in a falling market, there's a lot of disputes over deposits, and so if you can file such a document, then that makes much more pressure on the owner to make sure that deals with the deposit as quickly as possible.
Of course.
Okay, let's change gears. What about the foreign buyer's tax for people in the rest of our country? We, as you know, residentially speaking, we cannot sell any residential real estate in Canada to a foreigner, but we can sell commercial property to a foreigner, and BC adds a little kicker on it. They charge a 20% tax.
That's right, which is colloquially referred to as the foreign buyer's tax in British Columbia. So there was a recent case, this is a 2025 Court of Appeal case, and this case involves the application of the foreign buyer's tax. So very briefly, as we just discussed, for those that are unaware, when a foreign person purchases property in BC, they are subject to an additional 20% property transfer tax. In this case, the numbered company, this is the 108-4204 BC Limited, which I'll refer to as 108, was incorporated in British Columbia, but it was controlled by a foreign national. So the foreign national was the sole shareholder, officer, and director of 108. And therefore, this made 108 a foreign entity under the Property Transfer Tax Act because it was controlled by a non-Canadian. So 108 purchased a property in Saanich, British Columbia on the island, pursuant to a standard form contract to purchase and sale. 108 was listed as the transferee on the contract and the Form A transfer and the property transfer tax return, and was the registered owner of the property. Now, we've talked about bear trusts previously, I think, in other sessions that we've done. So basically, 108 was saying, no, we're not actually the owner, the true owner of this property. 108 is holding this property in trust for a Mr. Yi Su, who was a permanent resident of Canada and a common law spouse of the principal. So what happened here is that they said, the property transfer tax people said, it doesn't matter who is the beneficial owner. They only looked at, in this case, who was the registered owner on title, which was 108 and a foreign entity. So it didn't matter to them that it was being held in trust for a permanent resident of Canada. When they purchased the property, it was a foreign entity and the additional 20% tax applied. So there are certain circumstances, say, other than for income tax purposes, it would have been taxed, and this thing kind of thing would have been taxed in the hands of the beneficial owner. But for property transfer tax, yeah.
So what should somebody do? What should a buyer do to make sure that they don't get hit with that unexpected 20%?
Well, I think the easiest thing here would be is to make sure that the company is structured properly. Mm-hmm. So what they could have done in this case is they could have ensured that either a Canadian citizen or permanent resident was the voting shareholder of 108 and was a director of 108. If they had taken those steps, then 108 probably would not have been considered a foreign entity. Mm-hmm. So those aren't even necessarily the equity shares in the company. Those are just the control shares, the voting shares. If they had set that up so that it was a permanent resident or a Canadian citizen that had those voting shares and was appointed as director, 108 probably wouldn't have been considered a foreign entity and could have avoided this tax.
It's interesting, like in Thailand, for instance, you cannot own land. So what foreigners do, they buy the land inside a company and then become the managing director that has 49%. So it's just they are, it's a similar, not the same, of course, but a similar situation. The key is you need a lawyer to structure and cover yourself against all in eventualities. There they thought they had covered themselves and it didn't work, you know.
Yeah,
Okay,
so kind
next.
of unexpected 20%. Yes. Okay, onward. The next case I was going to discuss here was the NV Highway Properties Limited versus the 1155204 BC Limited. And this case dealt with it was a Court of Appeal case that upheld a $25.5 million real estate contract. Even though the seller didn't actually have title to the property at the time they entered into the contract. And there's an old legal principle, and my Latin is atrocious, but there's the legal principle, it's called the nemo dat non quod habet rule, which means that you can't sell a greater interest than you have in something. You can only transfer the actual interest that you have. However, in this case, the court determined that even though at the time the contract was entered into, the seller did not have title, at the time of completion, the seller did have title. So the buyer was obviously trying to get out of the contract for whatever reason in this case, saying that, well, at the time you signed the contract, you didn't own it. However, that's not the way the court found it. The court found that even though they didn't have title at the time the contract was entered into, they did have good marketable title at the time of completion, and that was all that was required. So the nemo dat rule did not apply in this case, and the seller was within their rights to enter into the contract and then subsequently sell it to the buyer, even though they didn't own it at the time the contract was entered into. It was just about their status as the owner on the completion date.
So what should they have done? Well, or what could they have done?
Well, I think for all the parties in this case, I mean, generally speaking, if you're going to do a deal, you're going to check to make sure that the seller actually has ownership and things like that. But I think the simplest solution in this case would have just been to include a subject clause in the contract where the parties agreed that the completion of the deal was subject to the seller acquiring good and marketable title at a specified date prior to the completion. So at least then that way you'd have an acknowledgement in the contract itself where the buyer is acknowledging that the seller, as of the date the contract is being signed, that the seller doesn't actually have title, but they are going to be acquiring title prior to the completion date. At least then it would have been very clear what the parties were agreeing to. And from the seller's perspective, even though the seller was ultimately proved to be correct in law here or within their rights, I imagine going through court proceedings and all the way through Court of Appeal proceedings, it would have been a lot easier if they had just had a clause in the contract saying, we don't own it now, but we will on the completion date. Probably a lot cheaper too.
Well, I always hate to say this that you do need a lawyer, but you do need a lawyer in certain situations. A heck of a lot cheaper to hire an expert to guard for all these eventualities. In a way, when we do a pre-sale contract, if I buy something in 2021 and then assign it to somebody else, I also don't own that property. I will own it, and I have every right to believe that I'm going to own it, but I'm really selling a just the rights of a contract that I have to somebody else. Interesting
That's right.
thing.
That's
Okay, what
right.
else do we have? Breach of
So
contract.
the last case I was going to touch on here was the Kulos Developments and Betalan case, which is a 2025 BC Court of Appeal case. And this is a case that deals with a buyer's remedies when a seller breaches a contract of purchase and sale. So when a seller refuses to complete, what are a buyer's remedies? So generally when a seller breaches a deal, there are generally two remedial options available for the court. The court can order that a seller pay damages to the buyer, in other words, that they pay money to the buyer, Or the seller can order specific performance, which means that the court will order that the seller actually complete the deal and transfer the property to the buyer.
So is it up to the buyer to choose?
It's not the buyer can say that they want or leave their remedies open, but at the end of the day, it's up to the court about which remedy that they're going to impose. Specific performance is a more limited remedy and not routinely awarded to the aggrieved buyers. Generally, a buyer will only be awarded specific performance if they are able to lead evidence showing that a property is unique in some way. For example, it's a waterfront property, or if it's an industrial property, that it has, specific loading bays and all that, and that it's unique in some way, and there's not a readily available substitute. So in this case, the parties entered into an option to purchase land in Kelowna, and the trial judge and the seller backed out. The trial judge found that the seller had breached the terms of the option to purchase, but declined to order specific performance of the agreement. So they declined to order the seller to complete the deal and limited the buyer's remedies to the recovery of damages to money. The buyer appealed on the basis that they should have been awarded specific performance. Now, in this case, there was no evidence. The buyer didn't lead any evidence that this property at issue was unique in the sense that there was no readily available replacement for the property. However, the court reaffirmed that specific performance, so forcing the sale, may be granted if the property is unique, not just because of the location of the property or something like that. But in this particular case, it was because of the amount of the pre-development work and site-specific planning that the buyer had engaged in for that property. Not that the property was irreplaceable, but the amount of work that the buyer had put into the pre-development planning and all that kind of stuff for that property. And in those circumstances, the court ordered that the sale take place. So it wasn't just about uniqueness, it was about the background work and feasibility steps that the buyer had taken prior to the seller backing out.
Yeah, an interesting, well, specific performance. Quite often, we used to say in the pre-sale world, the owner is going to sue you to perform the deal on the buyer side that you said you were going to buy this, and now you just want to walk away. It's not just a deposit you're going to lose. We're going to order you to maybe buy. So it is an interesting, it's interesting world. The legal world, in any case, is very interesting. I know that we had quite a bit of response to the points you made. As a father and as a mother, don't put yourself nilly willy on the title, or have add the daughter and the son to the title, and then enter with divorces and all sorts of things you hadn't bargained for. Because what people don't realize, even if you buy a property together, say all four are equal partners, one of them may have the duty to pay the whole thing if he is able to do that. It's not just my quarter is at risk. So interesting legal things. So
It's
let's
always interesting. The law is always evolving.
I think the next one we want to do is talk a little bit about the really tricky question about deemed disposition. And if you want to, as if you're older, if you get over 60, or if you even think about dying, my God, that's a show that you actually really have to watch. So,
We will be back for an OzBuzz podcast on deemed disposition shortly, I hope. And we can also work in some estate planning techniques and things like that, and some ways to work around the deemed disposition issue.
I'll be the one really paying close attention to that. So, thank you very much, and Stuart. We'll catch you next time.
Always a pleasure, Ozzy. Thank you.